The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Avery Schmitz with an episode of Chatter for April 2nd, 2023. For today's episode, the Lawfare team decided to cross-post this week's episode of Chatter, a podcast from David Freese and Shane Harris, featuring in-depth discussions with fascinating people at the creative edges of national security. Today's Chatter episode is entitled Debunking Nuclear Proliferation Myths with Malfred Brot-Hegghammer. In the episode, Freese sat down with Brot-Hegghammer to discuss challenges with countering the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, her research of covert nuclear programs, and more. This is Chatter.
Welcome to Chatter. I'm David Priest, publisher of Lawfare. This week, Norwegian political scientist Malfred Brot-Hegghammer debunking nuclear proliferation myths.
These are long projects. They take a really long time. You know, in some ways, they seem to take longer and longer. And so other priorities come in the way, and that can have really big consequences. The 2022 invasion of Ukraine really created a fear of nuclear war in Norwegian society that we haven't seen really since the 1980s. Nuclear weapons are likely to be more important for Russia in years to come, given the performance of its conventional forces. So I think the concern about nuclear weapons has certainly been reawakened.
Malfred, welcome to Chatter.
Thank you so much. Wonderful to be here.
I want to talk about nuclear weapons, specifically I want to talk about the proliferation of nuclear weapons and how countries seek to get them and the many ways in which they might fail. And you really have carved out a space for yourself working on this topic and doing some extraordinary research on it. But I'd like to go back to younger Malfred. So let's talk about how you first got interested in proliferation as a subject. I'm picturing a six-year-old girl in Oslo or nearby, who is sitting out in nature and suddenly has this revelation that her life's work will be devoted to proliferation of nuclear weapons. Please tell me I'm wrong.
You're half wrong and half right. I was probably sitting in nature somewhere because I grew up in a farm in Western Norway, but my dreams were much more in the direction of becoming a vet. So I failed terribly in that aspiration. But very shortly thereafter, I decided international politics strategy was the way to go for me. And the particular interest in, well, nuclear weapons and weapons of mass destruction came fairly early on, I would say. It came already when I was an undergraduate student in Wales in the UK, where nuclear strategy was a topic that had been taught for a long time. And when I was working on my master's, this was in the late summer of 2002, I thought, well, Iraq is an interesting topic because there were some inspections there at some point. And sure enough, it became an increasingly interesting topic as I was working on this thesis. I interviewed a lot of weapon scientists, and here we are 20 years later, and I'm still working on the same topic in a way. So it really caught me early on, and I'm still interested in it.
Do you remember what sparked your initial interest in international relations in general? Something in the news, or just looking at a globe and wanting to learn more about it?
I think that the boring answer is that I was always really interested in history, and I did read a lot of history even as a young child. The more exciting answer perhaps is that one of my first memories of international relations was the 91 Gulf War. And I remember being very concerned about this deadline that Saddam Hussein had been given and that there would be this terrible war. So it did strike me early on that this was something I was interested in and cared about. But of course, I had no idea just how interested I would become at that point.
We're similar in that way. I remember I was at my university when the war broke out, and my interest in history up to that point had been largely Middle Eastern history. For some reason, as a teenager, I got very interested in the history of the Arabian Peninsula and the regions around it. So I was very familiar with Kuwait and Iraq and Saudi Arabia. And I remember at my university, the war breaks out, and suddenly my roommate and my other friends are gathered around as I'm trying to tell them about Kuwait and Iraq and the Ottoman Empire and why this is an issue and all those things. And I was very popular for about 3 minutes, and then their boredom and common sense kicked in, and we all went off to do regular college things. You've studied in various places to expand your knowledge on this and your network on this. So talk through kind of how you went through university and got your doctorate and what you've been doing since then.
Sure. So I started studying in Wales in a university town called Aberystwyth, which was well known for its international relations department. And what I did not know when I applied but discovered when I arrived was that this was a place where the study of nuclear strategy had really been a stronghold for a very, very long time. And we are now circa 1999, when nuclear weapons were really not a very hot topic anymore. So it was slightly unusual to have such an emphasis on this in the department. But I took every class I could actually on nuclear weapons, and that was instrumental in my decision to change from international history to international relations. I was somehow just intuitively interested in technology and states and politics. I thought this is an interesting area to probe further. And I think that there is something about that combination that, you know, really continues to intrigue me. So going through my university studies there, I then proceeded to the London School of Economics, and we're now early 2002, or the summer rather of 2002, when the lead up to the Iraq war, the invasion was so present everywhere in the UK and in London in particular. And having started to interview some of the weapons scientists that were on the ground in Iraq throughout the 1990s to see if Iraq had actually destroyed its weapons of mass destruction as required by UN resolutions, I just became more and more interested, because it seemed like such a rich problem, or a set of problems, where, you know, you had to try and get a sense of some of the science, even as a non-scientist. And once, you know, you got your basic bearings there, what was more challenging was really to understand what was going on with the people and the institutions in Iraq. There were so many ideas that some of the scientists that were inspectors took with them to Iraq that didn't quite pan out or didn't quite work in their analysis, I thought. And similarly, there were some books about Iraqi governance, you know, prior to the 2003 war that really portrayed Iraq as a kind of authoritarian system where Saddam Hussein had complete oversight and control. So, and this really struck me as something I did not see when I started to interview, well, first of all, the inspectors, and then after the war, some of the Iraqis. So, yeah, so that's a long answer to try and outline sort of my way into this topic. But I just became interested in it right from the get-go, I would say, when I arrived in London and this invasion seemed increasingly likely.
And it did lead you to write a remarkable book several years ago, encapsulating some of your research and thinking on this, Unclear Physics, Why Iraq and Libya Failed to Build Nuclear Weapons. And in that book and elsewhere, you have argued that much of what we know about nuclear proliferation, or much of what we think we know about nuclear proliferation, and specifically why countries fail at it, is wrong. And I want to talk through some of that, because I think some of those misconceptions are still very prominent in the media and even in some sections of academia worldwide, especially as it regards these what you call personalist regimes in political science literature. The regime's very much focused on the strong man, and it usually is a strong man, taking over the state apparatus, being, if not authoritarian, semi-authoritarian. So let's do the Iraq case first, and then we'll compare and contrast a bit with Libya. As we get into the history, though, how did you do your research? Because many people have tried to look at issues somehow related to Iraq and proliferation, whether it was around the first Gulf War or whether it was around the invasion and the whole, you know, WND controversy there. But you were still able to find information no one else had. How did you do that?
So I would say that the research can be divided into two stages for especially the Iraq case. But actually, the same applies to a large extent to Libya, where my first efforts were focused on tracking down scientists and speaking to them and getting their stories and their version of what happened to really start there with their own recollections.
Malfried, were you surprised how many of them were willing to speak with you?
Initially, I was surprised. And then it dawned on me that I was lucky to be, you know, entering a culture where, you know, people are very keen to help students and, you know, take great care that, you know, you have had a big dinner by the time the interview is over, and are very hospitable and very, you know, helpful, I would say. So this kind of this really helped me. Everyone that I talked to introduced me to at least 2-3 more people. So initially I was surprised, but then gradually I thought, well, you know, this is an issue that really shaped their life. It shaped their working life for, in most cases, decades. And the aftermath, well, in both Iraq and Libya, but especially in Iraq, was so dramatic and so traumatic for many of these individuals and for their families that it made sense that they would want to have their version on the record, or at least speak, you know, their version of the story.
So what did you find? I mean, some of this was deep history. You go back to even before the Ba'ath coup in 1968, to some of the early thoughts about nuclear facilities in Iraq. But really, the program takes off after, what, 1973 or so. So walk through the research in that early time frame and what you found about Iraq's program, and then how the information from those scientists and others really helped feed some of these novel ideas that you've come up with about why states fail at nuclear proliferation.
Sure. So I would say that getting into the sort of deep historical roots of the program was essential. And I did that in large part through individual interviews, accessing many of their private papers from the program, and also by accessing the International Atomic Energy Agency's archive. So that combination was really essential because a lot of the perhaps mundane early planning, correspondence, field reports really was helpful in tracing the institutional development of these programs. And one striking observation for me was just how much reorganization and how many changes kept happening in the Iraqi program. This was partly connected to political developments and partly related to Saddam Hussein's efforts to avoid any potential challengers to his position. But it all amounted to an enormous amount of disruption. So it made it more difficult to sustain a program of this size and this complexity that, you know, a nuclear program tends to become. And so for me, that was an early observation that, you know, really told me something important about, you know, why it was difficult to obtain certain results in this program.
So what happened once Saddam, I would say, started to consolidate his rule? It wasn't yet 1979 where it was, if not absolute, close to it. But in the early 70s, as he was starting to consolidate his rule, at one point he sits down and instructs scientists to launch a program and explore a fuel cycle. What happened? Why do you think it happened at that time? And what did the scientists do with that guidance?
I think it happened at that time because there was suddenly a lot of money coming in to the coffers from the oil market in the early 1970s. So that's a big part of the explanation where it became possible to explore really expensive technologies. So the money is an important aspect. Another aspect is that this was a time when states were beginning to talk more seriously about imposing restrictions on exports of this kind of technology. So the Iraqis were also concerned that it would make sense to buy as much as possible before the controls in the international system made it difficult to acquire what they wanted to of the more sensitive technologies. It's a really interesting question. You know, what did Saddam's scientists do with his, you know, encouragement to pursue the nuclear fuel cycle without really a clear mandate? And I guess a short answer is that they interpreted that in rather different ways. Some of the scientists thought, well, let's just, you know, explore the nuclear fuel cycle, do basic science, do the kind of science that they were already interested in and were well acquainted with from their international careers. Others, and perhaps especially those that were, you know, card-carrying members of the Ba'ath Party, took this as an opportunity to pitch a nuclear weapons program. And so you had these two, at least two competing groups that were pitching ideas upward in the system. And according to my interpretation, Saddam did not really make it clear to either of them what his true intentions were. He kept that to himself and let these different groups sort of have their own assumptions about where this program was really going.
This gets to a fascinating point here, because I'll say that even my notions of an authoritarian state in something as special as a nuclear program, that I envision something that's probably more informed, despite my own political science background, it's probably more informed by James Bond movies and visions of villains in evil lairs than it is by reality. That if Saddam Hussein expresses an interest in a nuclear program and the scientists are feeding ideas up the chain, that this is what he spends his time, you know, sitting, stroking his chin, thinking about. And he has all of these apparatchiks and bureaucrats, you know, keeping a close eye on the program and giving him hourly or at least daily reports. And what you found is it was nothing like that, that Saddam was much more concerned about coup-proofing his own country and taking out rivals. He was concerned about Iran and Israel and relations with the U.S. and the Revolutionary Command Council itself, not just Saddam, lacked the mechanisms to review the progress of the program, that it was just kind of out there operating. And that's a huge shift in expectations from what most people bring to the table when it comes to what you think an authoritarian personality would be like when operating a nuclear program within his country. How do you account for that difference? What's the real issue, why the public perceives it one way and the reality, at least in the Iraqi case that you found, is so dramatically different?
I suspect that it partly has to do with what Bob Jervis and others have observed, that we tend to maybe assume that adversaries are more organized and more strategic than they perhaps are. And I do think that there was, you know, a really clear shift around the time of the 91 Gulf War in terms of how Saddam was portrayed. And he very much became, you know, a villain. It really is a striking contrast between, you know, what the sources reveal about the actual operations of this program and perhaps this sort of public image that was put across at that time, or later on in the 1990s, at least. And what I find so fascinating is that this was an issue that it was significant, because as you mentioned, Saddam Hussein and senior Iraqis were very concerned with the Iranian nuclear program and Iranian nuclear developments, and wanted, you know, regular reports and updates on this. But when it came to their own nuclear program, it was very much, an effort that lacked sort of a clear set of goals and milestones. At least in the 1970s, there was sort of a direction of travel, and there were, as I mentioned, different ideas among the scientists about what the end station would be, but it was not the kind of determined, focused effort that one assumes, you know, a nuclear weapons program proper would have. And that point comes through time and time again in the sources that describe the situation on the ground. And the title of the book, Unclear Physics, also points back to, you know, one of the typos in an annual report in the Iraqi nuclear program that states Department of Unclear Physics as opposed to Department of Nuclear Physics. And a senior scientist observing this just laughed and said, keep it, you know, like that. That's exactly what this is. Because, yeah, it wasn't really clear what direction this effort was taking. And I do think that suited some of the Iraqi scientists just fine, because then that gave them scope to pursue areas of interest. There was a lot of money available to do that as well.
You know, years ago, I heard a story about a researcher that was in the archives at one of the presidential libraries in the United States, and was found to have tampered with the archives. And you think that means they're doing something like, you know, destroying a document or modifying something to fit something they wanted to see. But in fact, this researcher had put a fake document into the archive to pretend they found it. And I thought that was odd. And what you just told me is such an amazing find. It's absolutely brilliant that you could find a report where nuclear physics was misspelled, and they actually decided that it characterized the program better to keep it as unclear physics. I'm not saying you put that into the archives and you found it because you placed it. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying if it wasn't there, this is the kind of thing you should do, because that is such an amazing characteristic about the Iraq program that comes out just in that mini story.
It is amazing. And it was, you know, when I realized that this should be the title of the book, it just made complete sense to me, you know, with regards to the argument. And I agree with you. It's a really powerful, powerful story. And I'm grateful to Jafar, the scientific leader of the Iraqi nuclear program, who had that recollection. of this report and this incredible typo. So, but honestly, I think this is also why I love archival research and why, for me, archives were essential for writing this book, because there are certain things that, you know, it's difficult to imagine that a thing like that would be possible. So, yeah, again, I'm a big fan of archives after working on this project, definitely.
Earlier you mentioned the IAEA archives, especially for these early years. Describe those archives to us, because that's a source I've never gone into for my own research, and I presume many listeners have not ever gone to research in the archives of the IAEA. But what kinds of information are there, and how robust is it on some of these early programs?
I found it to be an absolutely incredible resource and an essential one for what I hope to do, which was to really get a sense based on contemporary accounts of the situation on the ground in both of these countries, Iraq and Libya. When I started working in those archives, I believe I was among the early group of academics who got access to this archive. And this is a part of the agency archive that has the perhaps unappealing name of Technical Assistance Archives, which doesn't necessarily sound all that exciting if you're a political scientist or historian, but I just found it to be incredible. So this archive became accessible, and it contained both correspondence from the Iraqi and Libyan scientists about the structure of their organizations, restructuring of their organizations, what projects they were working on, plans for the future, as well as really rich descriptions from visiting scientists who were there to provide some, support or guidance in some aspects of these programs. So you
That's
sort
a gold
of had.
Mine. Or I should say, an enriched uranium mine. That's a wonderful thing to find.
It was incredible. And for me, I could not have written this book without those archives. And now more people, fortunately, are working in the archives. But this is primarily a resource for the IAEA itself. So it is not like a traditional archive, like a national archive. It is a slightly different thing, but that makes it all the more exciting to work in because you're in the organization.
That's right. Back to Iraq for a minute. We talked about the 1970s and the beginning, if you will, of a more robust program. And you took it forward to the Gulf War in 1990-91. But something happened in the middle there that was kind of important. And that's when Israel bombed the facility at Osirak in, I think, June 1981, sometime in early 1981. Mm-hmm. Describe what happened there and what that both did to the existing program, but what it did in terms of how Iraq envisioned its path towards a nuclear program.
So this is a question that has kept people busy for a few decades now. And what I perhaps brought to that discussion was a set of perspectives from within the Iraqi nuclear community, both at the time and then later on looking back. So the discussion about this strike was a strike that took out a reactor, research reactor complex. And the discussion has been, did this prevent Iraq from using that to develop a nuclear weapons, either optional capability, or was it not that important after all, and only sort of made Iraq more determined to get nuclear weapons so that Israel, which struck the reactor, wouldn't do so again. So based on my research, I would say that the Iraqi scientists did not see a direct role for this research reactor complex purchased from France in their, future potential nuclear weapons program. That it wasn't suited for this because of the way it was built and also because it was subject to regular inspections from the IAEA. And rebuilding it to make it suited for a nuclear weapons program would take a lot of time, and it would inevitably be discovered by someone. But the reactor was struck, and the result of this was that Saddam Hussein did indeed become more determined to acquire nuclear weapons sooner rather than later, took his leading scientist, one of them, out of prison. This is now Jafar, and said, you know, whatever you need to make us successful in this effort, you have it. And this triggered a program that proverbially sort of went underground, in the sense that they were took great care to design it in a way such that it would not be easily discovered and attacked again by, for example, Israel. They were deeply concerned about this prospect. So they pursued different kinds of technologies that would be mobile, so that they weren't so vulnerable with key nodes and key sites. And Saddam did not, you know, have a lot of advice for his nuclear scientists, but he did have one specific piece of advice, which was do this in a way where you build on indigenous capabilities rather than buying equipment from other countries, which is what they had done during the 1970s. So that was the instructions that Jafar and his colleagues worked with. And one thing I would say about this is that the program that emerged after June 1981 was sometimes, I think, misunderstood slightly by some Western observers who criticized it for using technologies that were sort of old and inefficient and so on. But what I found in the sources was that the Iraqis were not worried about efficiency, and they weren't, you know, really interested in having the cutting edge technology. They just wanted technologies that they could figure out and work with without being detected.
That is such an important insight there, because the projection that especially Western observers will do is this is a backward program, or this is because of those inefficiencies, this just shows how incompetent they are. And in fact, you revealed plenty of cases of incompetence in various ways in these programs you looked at. But the overall idea that because they're just going this route must mean that they don't know what they're doing, because there's much more advanced, efficient ways of doing it. But you're missing the point if you see it that way, right? Because you're not understanding that their highest goal is not to find the most efficient route. Their highest goal is to avoid discovery, yeah, and make sure they can do this without foreign interference.
Absolutely. And I'm really encouraged and delighted to see that a lot of subsequent scholarship has mm-hmm. has highlighted that and developed that point across other cases too, which right. which I think is important, because there is always a risk of bias. And I think one thing that comes through very clearly from the Iraqi sources is that they had a very thoughtful approach to selecting which technologies that they pursued, and you know, their assessment made sense given their priorities at the time. And of course, also what I argue in the book is that many of the delays and problems that they experienced in that effort during the 1980s had more to do with the institutional weaknesses than the skill of the engineers and scientists. They had, you know, terrific scientists and engineers. That was not the problem.
After the Gulf War, the world learned how much progress Iraq had made during that decade. And I remember, I think it was an IAEA report. It was some report that had a lot of credibility in the late 1990s, 1997, 1998, that came out that revealed Iraq was very, very close. Some Iraqi scientists said they were within 4 or 5 years of obtaining the ability to manufacture a nuclear device. Other Iraqi scientists, though, and I find this fascinating, you talk to people who within the program disagreed with this, that they themselves weren't sure where they were at and how fast their progress would be. Is that because of this dynamic you've described of the program not being well managed, not being well led, that it could lead to very different interpretations of where they were at?
I certainly think that there was fierce competition between sort of two tracks in that program. And, you know, the scientists that worked in one track had very strong opinions about the progress made in the other track. So I think that is certainly part of the picture here, that, you know, that there was competition then and that this continues to this day to shape their assessments of the overall performance of the program. I would say that to me, it is very striking to see the increasing advance that, you know, was made overall in the Iraqi nuclear program by the late 1980s. I mean, they were really serious about this and starting to think about perhaps, testing and so on. It was a very serious program. And the problems that they had were, they were in the process of resolving many of those. That said, it is difficult, I think, to put an exact timeline. I think we're talking a number of years, perhaps less than a decade. But it all comes down to how big of a rush the Iraqis thought that they were in. And prior to the invasion of Kuwait, I'm not sure that there was necessarily a great sense of urgency on their part. For the IAEA to say that the Iraqis were close to a breakthrough by 1991 really is a big deal. And it was a big deal because, as I mentioned earlier, the Iraqi nuclear facilities were under regular inspections. And when the IAEA discovers in 91 that there had been a sprawling nuclear weapons program in various other facilities, but also concealed within some of their declared facilities, this was not great for the standing of the IAEA. And that led to the creation of what is now known as the Additional Protocol. But again, back in the early 90s, it was a very serious issue that the IAEA indeed took very seriously. But it all underscores that, their judgment about the progress of the Iraqi program is one to indeed take very seriously.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at UH1.com.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. I want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contains some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers and that the one with the most information about me was called HLEC. I have no idea what HLEC is. So the other day, I got my latest report, and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me.
as this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there. And these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code LAWFARE20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/LAWFARE20, code LAWFARE20.
And there are two interesting implications of that, one of which is well known and one of which I read in your work for the first time. The one that I think people have heard before is what came out about the Iraqi WMD programs writ large after the invasion of Kuwait and the inspections that came after was that Iraq was further along in its programs generally, but in several ways was further along than outside analysts had assumed. And that in turn fed into assumptions about Iraq WMD going into the 2002-2003 framework, that set expectations for what Iraq was able to do covertly and whether they were telling the truth publicly. But the other one was about the Kuwait invasion itself. The fact that you just mentioned that Iraq invaded Kuwait at a time when there was significant progress being made in these programs, and maybe it wasn't 2 or 3 years, but it probably wasn't 2 or 3 decades that we would have breakthrough. The very fact that Saddam would invade Kuwait at such a sensitive time actually tells us something about how important he felt the nuclear program was, doesn't it?
I certainly think so. It was something that several senior Iraqi scientists mentioned that baffled them, that they believed if, you know, Saddam had not invaded Kuwait, he would have ended up with nuclear weapons at some stage. And they were really surprised, you know, that he made this decision at that point in time. And also, you know, there were meetings after the invasion of Kuwait where Saddam's son-in-law Hussein Kamel was trying to reassure Saddam Hussein that this crash program that they had launched after the invasion to quickly produce a nuclear device of some kind, that they were, you know, doing really well and were, you know, close to success, which was a large exaggeration. That Saddam Hussein apparently wasn't paying much attention, that he was looking out the window and seemed preoccupied with other matters. So I think you're spot on. And I do think that it tells us something important about nuclear weapons programs, that these are long projects. They take a really long time. In some ways, they seem to take longer and longer for countries. And so other priorities come in the way. And it can that can have really, you know, big consequences, as in this particular case.
Yeah. Let's compare and contrast with Libya. A fascinating pairing for this, because there are so many similarities that one would not have seen unless they talked to the scientists and dug into the archives, all the things you've done. And yet the few different variables really do highlight some interesting things about both what we think we know about Saddam Hussein and Muammar Gaddafi, and also about nuclear weapons programs in these personalist states. So to set the stage a bit, we won't go into the deep history, but in 1969, the self-proclaimed Revolutionary Command Council comes in with Gaddafi in the lead. And suddenly there's a new government, but it's a very poor country. They don't have a lot of infrastructure. And yet you found that when Libya later declared that they had started nuclear program in 1973, they weren't quite telling the full truth, because you found things going on within months of Gaddafi coming into power, I think in 1970. Talk about the roots of the Libyan program and how that developed during the 1970s.
So very early on after the coup, Gaddafi and his, you know, fellow travelers were interested in nuclear weapons, and they reached out to China, and they reached out to Nasser in Egypt, trying to figure out if there was any kind of shortcut to, well, essentially buying the bomb. They were not encouraged by the answers that they got. And it became clear fairly early on that it would be necessary to develop their own communities of science and engineering. And that would be a long road to travel for the Libyans, given this very different starting point Libya had compared with Iraq when it came to sort of the educational resources in the country, a very, very different state altogether. And most significantly, perhaps, in my mind, was Gaddafi's own revolutionary project of the stateless state that he gradually developed, where, you know, the starting point was a weak state to begin with. And then his project of weakening it further really created significant obstacles to any kind of planning of a project of the size and complexity that a nuclear program or nuclear weapons program would entail.
That's so counterintuitive for people who only saw Gaddafi as the caricature that he, in some ways, reinforced with his own behavior in the 1980s, but Gaddafi as being the dictator, the person in charge. And you can imagine, again, that image of him sitting down and directing the scientists what to do and watching them like a hawk. But instead, the entire philosophy, especially in the 70s, was we're breaking down these institutions, which are already weak, and therefore we will have almost no planning, almost no insight, and almost no control, even on a program as sensitive as a nuclear one. It's a fascinating thing to think about.
It is indeed. And I think that, you know, reading some of the archival documents from the Libyan program were some of the more astounding, you know, observations that I made, where, you know, it was really a directionless kind of effort, where there was no sort of sense of planning, of procurement, of buying of technology. So they would buy equipment that sat in the boxes unopened, and in some case duplicates, or they would, you know, buy the wrong kind of equipment. And many of the scientists did not show up to work especially often, because either they found, you know, the commute to be a bit long, or they had to essentially subsidize their own salary by teaching at universities. So, and perhaps the most astounding example was a number of these scientists came from Egypt. And during sort of border conflicts between Egypt and Libya, some of these scientists that had come from Egypt went on strike to get, you know, better pay and conditions. So it, you know, it tells you something about the state of affairs when when this kind of stuff is going on, it's very far from this sort of, yeah, caricature that indeed Gaddafi tried to portray himself, I think.
Of course, things changed dramatically in Libya in the 1970s because of the earlier discovery of oil, but then, of course, the huge increase in prices. And what we then saw was something which, again, some similarities to Iraq, but it played out in a different way, which is people understood that Libya was trying a bunch of different things. I mean, everything from this huge man-made river project to crash programs to industrialized parts of the country. So much of it not working, right? Just the inability to get anything actually done because there wasn't the planning. But on the nuclear side, it looked like they were buying a wide range of facilities in this period. They were trying to get services from abroad. It looked like they were trying to launch a crash program. But in fact, it just looked like they had a lot of money and they were throwing it around in every way they could to try to go every path towards buying a nuclear facility and try to get reactors from this country or that country. It wasn't nearly as organized as it might have looked from the outside in terms of a crash program with a logic to it. It was, they were flush with cash, and this was something that they decided they could just invest in.
Absolutely. And there are a number of examples of how the sort of the lack of planning impeded, you know, any kind of effort emerging from the combination of cash and equipment. And another side to this is that, you know, there were some very, very smart people in charge of this program at this point in time, but they were not really able to build, you know, a cadre of scientists and engineers to do the work, essentially. They found it difficult to convince people to join these programs. Smart people, engineers, typically wanted to work in the oil industry instead. So they were continuously struggling with this shortage of manpower and also this inability to really sort of launch a complex program and get it off the ground, essentially.
Yeah. So eventually, as you go through the 1980s and you get to 1989, 1990, effort after effort to be buying things, right, from the Soviet Union, I think, and then turning to the French and the Belgians and who knows who else, it just wasn't working. What was the turn in the Libyan program when they decided they couldn't get this? Obviously, they didn't have the indigenous capability. They didn't even have physics classes in Libya a couple of decades earlier. They didn't have the personnel. They didn't have the expertise. They didn't have the infrastructure. You try to bring in outside help. You try to bring in countries giving you facilities or materials or buying them from countries. But what's the other path and where did they go in the 1990s?
So in the early 1990s, along came AQ Khan, who actually offered both to Iraq and to Libya another route, which was to buy, the full package, weapons, designs, centrifuges. And, you know, the Libyans became his best customer, essentially, and spent quite a lot of money asking for, you know, a ready-made package of centrifuges. They were soon to be disappointed, however, because what they realized was that these were very much secondhand items that were, you know, leftovers from the Pakistani program, essentially, and that they were not sold as a package. They were not assembled. They did not receive the help that they needed, you know, to build the centrifuges, essentially. So they the Libyans found that it wasn't really a shortcut after all, and soon became sort of very disaffected with their AQ Khan experience. But that was very much sort of the opportunity that came along that made the Libyans decide to sort of try again after a rather difficult period in the 1980s where these other efforts that you mentioned didn't really go anywhere. So they had high hopes for the AQCon network, but didn't see much in terms of success.
And this is the time frame, if I'm right, that senior leaders, a very small group of them, but senior leaders did start taking more of an interest in the nuclear program. And I know you heard some of this directly from Saif al-Islam Gaddafi, one of Muammar Gaddafi's sons. Tell me a little bit about interviewing him and the insights you got from someone who is both so close to Gaddafi, but someone who, while certainly not a nuclear scientist in any way, somebody who was almost like the fixer, right? Someone who was coming in with the authority that came from his connections to try to spur this program forward.
So I found all of the interviews I did in Libya to be really fascinating, and each and every one gave me sort of new insights into the Libyan system, essentially, and how, you know, how it worked, and more importantly, how it didn't work in ways that I hadn't quite imagined from the get-go. With regards to Saif al-Islam, that was a really interesting, well, it was a couple of interviews, actually rather close to his white tiger. So that was an added sort of bit of excitement, I wow. suppose. But I spoke to him, and I spoke to some of the senior Libyan officials who were sort of very much involved in the talks that led to the decision to give up on the bomb, essentially. And my impression was that Saif was very important in having access, you know, to the great leader, to Muammar Gaddafi, and as someone who had his ear and could sort of lean in on that decision to encourage Muammar Gaddafi to decide to give up the bomb, when there were certainly, according to Saif, this was a long-standing dream for some of the other Libyan officials within the military circles to get nuclear weapons. So it was I think important from the internal point of view to have him take such a strong position on this, and for him to try and ultimately succeed in persuading Muammar Gaddafi to give up on the bomb. There is also, I think, the risk that Saif's role could be perhaps somewhat exaggerated. I think he was very much jostling for power, as he apparently is even to this day, but he certainly was back in 2005, 2006. So it was important for me to qualify some of those claims and check them against other participants in those talks, which included, of course, some of the most senior and trusted Libyan officials who engaged in these trilateral talks with the US and the United Kingdom that initially focused on the Lockerbie trial and then culminated with the WMD abandoning decision.
Talk about that decision a bit, because I think there still is some public misunderstanding of that just based on the timing, right? It was announced that Libya was giving up all of its programs, what, late 2003? And of course, by then there'd been the invasion of Iraq, 9/11 had happened, and it's hard for people not to see some causation in the correlation of the timing. But of course, Libya had decided to give up its program and use it as a bargaining chip, if you will, long before that. Walk us through that process and the actual timing of Libya's decision.
Yeah, no, it is impossible, I think, to completely isolate that decision from the developments in Iraq that year that I think put a new sense of urgency, I think, definitely within the Libyan regime to settle this issue. But my clear impression, based on, you know, what not only Libyan officials said, but US and UK participants in the trilateral talks and accounts, written accounts from that time, was that the Libyans had offered in principle years earlier, when they started this process of trying to improve relations with the US and the UK, where it was the US and the UK that insisted on a phased approach of doing, you know, settling one issue and then moving to the next. And the Lockerbie trial was of course essential to resolve first. So that was clearly very important and took quite a long time. And once that trial, these things had been resolved, the WMD issue was next on the list. There were other important items as well that the Libyans did not want to discuss. One, for example, being the killing of British policewoman Yvonne Fletcher in London, where it is widely believed that a very senior Libyan official was involved, if not actually pulling the trigger. So there were certain other issues that, you know, were left unresolved. But the WMD decision was in many ways the big one. And it became an important priority for all parties, I believe, because of the Iraq war and the need on the US and the UK side to have a big breakthrough in the WMD area. And Libya was sort of teed up in a way to be just that. So I would say, yes, the context is important, but in principle, the offer had been on the table for years before that.
Wow. So after this, of course, the IAEA and countries like the United States go in and get all of the equipment and all of the records that they can find. And basically, the Libyan nuclear program is done. And what you find digging back into the research is that, yes, the Libyan program had been revived. There had been enormous investments made. They had a lot of equipment. But it's still, to put it politely, it was still underperforming as a nuclear program. Why is that? And this is a good point to compare it to the Iraq case. Why was it underperforming so much, given that it had some advantages in some important ways?
Yeah, I think here is when you really see the, you know, the consequences of this stateless state experiment that Gaddafi had started, where, you know, planning, coordination, and, you know, monitoring progress became very, very difficult. There were some really smart scientists leading the Libyan nuclear program. So I think it would be a mistake to, you know, to underestimate their abilities, because they knew what they were doing. But as a person who was on the ground and interacted with them said, you know, there was just no bench in Libya. They didn't have enough people who were, you know, willing and able to pull off a program of this size. And it turned out that this AQCON assistance in some ways was creating new problems rather than creating the shortcut that they perhaps had hoped for. So it is a very different setting from the Iraqi program, where, you know, there was competing tracks and you know, increasing progress during the 1980s. The Libyan project suffered from, you know, the same kinds of problems that they had suffered from all along, which had to do with, you know, the dysfunction of the Libyan state and Libyan institutions, that, you know, there was no way to buy a fix out of those problems.
So I'm thinking here about the implications of this, and there's a few, some of them kind of about our views of these personalist regimes, and some of them about nuclear proliferation in the years since you've done this research. Let's hit the first one first. It sure seems to me, having, you know, read your analysis of Iraq and Libya and hearing you explain it here, that we have this vision that these leaders, these authoritarian style leaders, basically always get what they want and they have few constraints on their abilities. And at least in this area, which is a pretty sensitive area, you would think this would be a strong case for that. And even in these cases, you poke some holes in that conception, right?
Well, I'm trying, because I think it's one of the most important observations for me coming out of this project, is that leaders such as Saddam and Gaddafi, their path to consolidating power involved weakening state institutions. And they went about it in slightly different ways. Gaddafi had his very own style, as we've talked about, of the sort of stateless state and trying to weaken bureaucracy. And so, you know, in each of these cases, however, you know, weakening state institutions had really serious implications for their own oversight of what was going on. And, you know, time and time again, Saddam tried to keep tabs on what was going on in the nuclear weapons program in the 1980s, and finds that it's very difficult to get clear answers, and that the programs are sort of changing shape and changing reporting formats all the time, so that it becomes very, very difficult to figure out, you know, what's going on and how is the actual progress panning out. And there are these amazing exchanges where Saddam complains about getting too many reports and too much reading material, and he's overwhelmed with, you know, the amount of decisions he has to make.
Right.
And of course, that's sort of, one would imagine that's the life of a personalist ruler. But it is quite striking how, you know, difficult it is and how much he complains about implementation problems and his staff not really doing what he's telling them to, even, as you say, in the case of the nuclear weapons programs. And so it's just very, very different from what I expected to see sort of going into this research. And I do think that this is an important point, because I think my suspicion is that this goes on in other personalist regimes as well. Mm. And that it's not, you know, it may be worse in the cases like Saddam and Gaddafi, but it goes on elsewhere too. And that, you know, that's important for understanding, you know, the trajectory of these kinds of programs in authoritarian type systems.
Let's talk about some of those other potential countries, because there are many, many countries without nuclear weapons, and yet many countries that have some of the capability and infrastructure that these countries were building. So at one extreme are the countries, and there are many, but I can think of Japan, Canada, Germany, countries that have the government infrastructure, have the ability to do planning of projects, have the technology, have the personnel that could presumably have a nuclear breakout almost any time they chose to as a matter of policy. On the other side are the countries that are more like a Libya originally, which may have a desire, which presumably Germany right now does not, but may have a desire for a nuclear program, but they don't have any of those benefits. Most countries seem to be in the middle, and those variables break out differently. Like North Korea and Iran are very different than Libya and Iraq in important ways, as are Saudi Arabia and Turkey and others that have either speculated themselves about an interest in a nuclear capability should other things in their regional circumstances change, or others have speculated about them. So talk through that range of other potential proliferators and how you see what you've learned about proliferation from these case studies applying to other cases of proliferation today.
So I think that, first of all, many of these countries have been paying attention to both Iraq and Libya and what, you know, what transpired in both of those cases, and have reached their own conclusions about what not to do. And what not to do is to agree to the agreement that Libya did, or in the case of Iraq, admits inspectors to verify WMD disarmament. Neither of those models of rollback or disarmament are likely to appeal to any other country. And in fact, Iran and North Korea have been quite clear that they are not interested in a so-called Libya model. In terms of the capabilities and, you know, systems of governance in these other countries, I think we're looking at a very different landscape. We're also looking at a landscape that is, you know, several decades later, where technology has changed, and the countries that are, you know, of greater concern now are countries that, you know, as you outline, have had a long time to develop nuclear capabilities and are closer to a kind of a latent capability should they decide that their security environment has changed. And many of those countries, you know, are now sort of increasing concern, South Korea being one of them, and in, you know, Saudi Arabia, perhaps another. And even in Europe, you know, concerns about, you know, the credibility of U.S. commitment to its allies are, I think, leading to an unease that will perhaps inform how states position themselves in a different way of moving forward. So I think that, you know, this is a very different kind of landscape and different kinds of states from these personalist kinds of systems that, you know, I observed in the cases of Iraq and Libya.
One of your other research interest areas is nuclear issues overlapping with the High North. And the Russian invasion of Ukraine has changed so many of our expectations about cooperation, the Arctic Council being essentially useless at this point, to be very blunt, and the security concerns of Sweden and Finland prompting them to rapidly shift and apply to NATO, the enhancement of security cooperation of Norway with many other partners in the High North. Do you see any nuclear angle to this, presuming that Russia does not begin behaving like a civilized nation? What are those implications?
So I think one implication that that there seems to be a broad consensus on in the Norwegian landscape is that nuclear weapons are likely to be more important for Russia in years to come, given the performance of its conventional forces. Mm-hmm. And this will likely be felt in the High North in particular. So I think there is a sense of difficulties ahead where, you know, this increasing reliance on nuclear weapons in this part of the world, combined with, you know, the falling apart of these arrangements whereby Norway and Russia would, you know, provide, have at least some sense of cooperation to in terms of, you know, nuclear pollution and things of that nature, that at least was, gave us some ways in which to communicate, even when things were difficult in the past. These are now, you know, falling apart as well. So more tension, less communication is indeed cause for concern, especially when you pair this with the anticipated NATO expansion, really sort of redrawing the strategic map of Northern Europe, and adding to that the increasing interest of China in this region. I think the scene is really set for some significant problems and turbulence ahead.
It certainly changes the strategic landscape a bit, that it does appear China is poised to, frankly, take advantage of Russia's need and gain great access to the Northern Sea routes and to Russian port facilities, presumably even buying up Russian resources in the High North in a way that does look like China's role in the Arctic will be dramatically higher in 5 or 10 years than even a straight line projection before the Russian invasion of Ukraine would have suggested. And that, of course, does raise some potential nuclear issues depending on how conflicts could emerge in the region. Are you getting the sense that that concern is permeating beyond Norwegian political scientists and military planners and think tank analysts, but getting into the population, that the people are actually thinking about the danger of some kind of nuclear escalation in a future conflict?
That's a great question. I would say that the invasion of the 2022 invasion of Ukraine really created a fear of nuclear war in Norwegian society that we haven't seen really since the 1980s. People were really, really scared in a way that, you know, we haven't seen this in a very long time. So I think that the concern about nuclear weapons has certainly been reawakened. I would also, you know, assume that the shift in support for NATO in Sweden and even more strikingly in Finland suggests perhaps something similar, that that people have become you know, alert to these issues in a very different way. So does that mean that there is you know, a great emphasis on, you know, deterrence and reassurance and risk reduction conversation around dinner tables throughout Norwegian society? Probably not. And here I really think that, you know, academics, researchers, experts, and of course politicians have a really important task ahead of them, which is to really explain the issues, explain the risks, and talk about the toolkit, because a lot of this has been forgotten. After the end of the Cold War, this became a very specialized area of interest. And so I think it's really important to take the time to delve into these issues and really spell them out. You know, even at, you know, in, you know, areas of the bureaucracy where, you know, you would think that deterrence would be sort of the bread and butter of what people are doing, you find that actually people mean very different things nowadays when they talk about deterrence. This is now clear in a very different way than, you know, it has been for quite a long time. So I do think that, you know, there's a lot of work ahead of us in talking about these dangers and how to tackle them as a small country.
Absolutely. Well, let's reach into our chatterbox and surprise you with some random question. Malfried, please name one dead political or national security related leader from any era that we could really use right now.
I know exactly. Johan Jørgen Holst, who was a Norwegian statesman, minister of defense, minister of foreign affairs, who was also, you know, who knew arms control and understood arms control better than most, who was a really central figure in handling some of the pre-INF debates within NATO, and was someone who really had a rich and deep understanding of the sort of the theory of deterrence, but also the political toolkit for how to work out solutions to really difficult problems. I would be very, very interested to get his take on where we go from here, as he was someone who, you know, early on focused on deterrence and reassurance as, you know, the framing conceptual pair for Norwegian security policy. We're still trying to figure out how to do both of those things in these changing, you know, situations and environments. I would love to get his take on that.
As would I. A wonderful choice. Malfried, thank you for spending so much time talking about your research interests, your archival and interview research, the implications of all of it, and current events. We've hit it all. I appreciate it.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
That was Chatter, a production of Lawfare and Goat Rodeo. Please subscribe to the podcast and find us on Twitter at @ThatWasChatter.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.